You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole translators of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works volume by Rudolf Steiner, number 181, with three cycles in it. We just finished Dying Earth and Living Cosmos. This is now the second cycle in the same book, entitled The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, beginning with Lecture 8, given in Berlin on the 30th of March, 1918, translated by Matthew Barton. If you have rightly understood what I said in the last few lectures about the soul determining how we relate to supersensible worlds, how we ourselves can work to nurture this relationship, you will not need to feel anxious when you hear the simple truth that we are also in a sense reliant and dependent on the whole cosmos, on all our surroundings. Human life swings back and forth between these two things, between freely creating a relationship with the world of spirit and dependence on our surroundings, on the whole cosmos, due largely to the fact that we are bound up with a specific physical body between birth and death. In the coming days, I want to speak about a particular aspect of this dependence on the universe, which can seem especially relevant to us nowadays. Your study of spiritual science will have shown you, in particular, that the whole earth we inhabit, as all of humanity, is a kind of great living being, and that we ourselves live within this living entity as its limbs. In various lectures, I have spoken about how this great living entity, the earth, manifests in diverse phenomena. The life of our earth is expressed in the most varied ways, among other things, in the kinds of relationship that exist between distinct areas of the globe and the human beings living there. While it is superficially true to say that the human race is one, a unified whole, it is equally true that this human race is differentiated depending on geographical locality, and that human beings are dependent not only on the many forces studied by mainstream science and geography, but also on many hidden forces in diverse places across the face of the globe. Human beings have an inner relationship with the places where they live and the parts of the world where they originated, and ordinary science usually does not delve deep enough to reveal these. These connections and relationships are ones created over longer historical periods. We can discern something of this in the changes undergone by Europeans who moved to America and settled there. Of course, the period during which America has been settled by Europeans is so brief still that there are as yet only hints, though strong and clear ones, of what I mean. The Europeans' external appearance changes, or at least there are hints and indications of this, when he settles in America. This does not happen immediately, but after several generations. It can be detected in the form of arms and hands, for instance, but also in the countenance. Gradually and subtly, the faces of Europeans begin to assemble those of Native Americans, slowly beginning to acquire the qualities and characteristics of that people. Such things can indicate certain connections between the great organism of the earth and the diverse parts of this organism, the different peoples who live upon the earth. We know, of course, that we live on earth in connection with supersensible beings, with beings of higher hierarchies. What we have called the folk soul is not an empty abstraction, but rather a kind of archangel being. If you read the lecture cycle I gave about folk souls in Christiania, Oslo, you will find that such a folk soul is an actual, real being, in whom our lives are, in a sense, embedded. We are, in general, always connected with higher and lower beings of the higher hierarchies in some way. Today and in the next few days, we will study this connection from a certain angle, for such things can only ever be studied from a particular perspective. To start with, it is important to remind ourselves that what is regarded in the materialistic outlook as matter or substance does not actually exist for the spiritual scientist. A really careful and detailed mode of observation finds that substance resolves into spirit. I have often used a comparison to show what I mean here. Think of water. It turns to ice if it freezes and then looks quite different. Yet ice is still water, only in a different form. The same is roughly true of what we call matter. It is spirit in a different form. It assumes a different form just as the water does when it becomes ice. In terms of spiritual science, therefore, when we speak of material processes, we keep spirit in view. The dynamic spirit pervades everything, and the fact that it also comes to expression in material processes shows one way in which it manifests. Spirit is active everywhere. And so if we consider more material phenomena, we are really speaking of the way spirit acts. How, in a certain domain, it reveals itself in outward and more or less material processes. Material processes, which are really spiritual processes, continually occur within us. We eat, and thereby assimilate substances of the outer world into our own organism. Solid substances, rendered liquid, are absorbed in the human organism and undergo a metamorphosis. The human organism consists of all kinds of substances which it assimilates from outside. As it does so, these substances pass through a process. Our bodily warmth is generated by the warmth we absorb and by processes which the substances we assimilate undergo within our organism. We breathe, and in doing so we take in oxygen. Yet we not only take in oxygen, but also, at the same time, enter into the rhythms of the outer world, since our processes of respiration are connected with what occurs in the outer atmosphere. Our own rhythm is embedded in the rhythm of the whole universe. On one occasion, I even described this relationship in numerical terms. We are related to our surroundings in a certain way through the rhythmic processes at work in our own organism. Outer processes in nature play into us, play on in us. And this also means, in fact, that the effects of the folk spirit, for instance, are mediated to each individual. We not only breathe oxygen, but something spiritual lives in it. The folk spirit can live in our breathing of oxygen. In eating, we assimilate substances, and here too the process is, at the same time, also spiritual, and one in which the folk spirit can live. The folk spirit lives with us in a way that is not merely abstract. Its life informs all that we do each day, the processes in our organism. Material processes are, at the same time, the expression of spiritual modes of action. The folk spirit thus enters us in a mediated way through our breathing and our nutrition. The various different folk spirits we described from another point of view in the lecture cycle on folk souls and Nordic mythology act on human beings in divergent ways, and this distinguishes the different characteristics of nations and races on earth. These characteristics depend on the folk spirits. But if we study the mediated ways in which different folk spirits act, we find such things as the following. We breathe in and out, and this means we are continually connected with the air around us. And where, in a specific instance, the folk spirit chooses to act through the medium of breathing, thus creating the distinctive characteristics and configuration of a particular people, We find that it acts on this people via the air or atmosphere. This is especially striking in races that have ever inhabited the Italian peninsula, where air mediates the effects of the folk spirit on human beings. We can say that the air of Italy is the means or medium which the folk spirit employs to act within people who live in Italy, giving them the characteristics that have made them Italian, and further back in the past, the Roman people. In other words, apparently material effects can be traced back to underlying spiritual causes, if we study these things through spiritual science. What about other folk spirits? What medium do they choose, in other cases, to bring a particular nation's distinctive characteristics to expression? The folk spirit of peoples who have inhabited France, or still do today, acts via the fluid element, through everything that they not only imbibe as fluid, but also all the fluids that work within them. So this folk spirit weaves and reverberates in the French through the way in which fluids shape and influence the organism, and this gives rise to the distinctive characteristics of this people, both today and in the past. But this relationship between a people and their surroundings is somewhat more complex. There is more to it than this. Remember that I said human beings have a dual nature, with a head distinct from the rest of the organism. The actions of the folk spirit on the Italians and the French, as I described them, relate only to the rest of the organism other than the head, while another kind of effect proceeds from the head. The full character of a people arises only from a combination of the effect emanating from the head and that proceeding from the rest of the organism. We can say that the effect issuing from the head is neutralized by the other action which comes from the rest of the organism. What the inhabitants of Italy breathe in with the air, which has a determining effect on their organism, except for the head, via breathing, combines with the way in which the head's nervous system is configured, the way in which it is spiritually differentiated, insofar as the head's neural activity is concerned. In France, it is different. There, what lives as rhythm in the organism is a distinctive rhythm for the whole organism, and distinctive again for the head. The head has its own rhythm. Whereas in Italy, the head's neural activity combines with the actions of the air on the human being, in France, the rhythmic movement in the head, the resonance of the rhythm in the head, is caused by the actions of fluid in the organism. Thus the character of a people develops through the specific interaction of something individually human in the head with the actions of the folk spirit coming from locality and surroundings. Spiritual scientific observations enable us to study how these things are differentiated across the globe. We cannot actually understand the distinctions and differences between nations if we do not look at them in this way. What about the British character? Just as the folk spirit of Italy is mediated by the air, and that of France by everything fluid, so the British folk spirit is mediated by everything of an earthly quality, chiefly salt and its compounds in the organism. The chief element here is solidity. In contrast to the fluidity at work in the character of the French people, the British character is informed by the consolidating element of salt absorbed through breathing and nutrition. And this gives rise to the distinctive quality of the British. But here again, an effect proceeds from the head and somewhat neutralizes what enters from outer surroundings. As well as rhythm in the head and the rest of the organism, both these also possess digestion and metabolism. The British character arises from the way the head accomplishes its metabolism, an exchange of substances, in interplay with the salt element in the rest of the organism. This character emerges from the earthly element in combination with the head's metabolism. And we can say that as it works through the salt element, the folk soul here encounters or comes up against the distinctive nature of the head's metabolism. In this way, taking account of these differently mediated metamorphoses, you can study all the different characters of a race or nation. Looking further westward, we find a sub-earthly element working in the American people. While the British character is connected with the earth element, salt, a sub-earthly quality, is active in the American character, something that resonates below the earth's surface, and this is what primarily influences the organism there. The folk spirit in America acts especially by rising through subterranean magnetic and electrical currents, meeting a stream descending from the head, which in turn neutralizes this influence and has the quality of human will. That is the distinctive character of the American people. While the British character is largely connected with the earthly element absorbed into the organism and entering into interplay with the head's metabolism, the character of the American people arises from the distinctive nature of the will combining with what rises from a subterranean sphere. This is also connected with something I said in the public lecture. We can only develop freely and independently where we connect with an element on or above the earth. If we are influenced by sub-earthly actions of the folk soul, we do not develop free characteristics, but are in a sense possessed by this folk soul. In my public lecture, I described this by showing that although an American and a European may seem to say the same thing, I'm thinking of Woodrow Wilson and Hermann Grimm, we find that in the latter case, everything has been hard-earned by human effort, whereas the words of the former betray a kind of possession. There is something important to note here, especially important in our day and age. If two or three people apparently say the same thing, people consider only the abstract content of their words. Yet, while the content of two people's words can be identical, while they seem to be saying exactly the same as each other, one of them may be expressing things he has struggled hard to formulate, while the other has simply acquired them effortlessly through a kind of possession. The content is often not the thing of primary importance, but the degree to which this content is the fruit of inner labor, or has simply been received through a sort of possession. This is important. Nowadays, people only have a sense of things in the abstract. In the case of Hermann Grimm, you can see that he only uttered things he had pondered many times inwardly. You can take phrases written by Wilson and put Grimm's name on them, and vice versa, but that is not what matters. What Hermann Grimm writes has been hard-earned, whereas Woodrow Wilson's phrases have a quality of possession, something entering from subterranean entities. These things can be perceived. There is no need to get emotionally worked up about them, but we can just bring objective detachment to bear on them. We will come back to Germany in a moment, but first let us move on further eastward. The nature of Eastern people will only gradually emerge from chaos to reveal its intrinsic quality. And here we encounter something striking. In Italy, the folk spirit works through air, in France through water, in England through earth, and in America through a sub-earthly element. In Russians and Slavs, the folk spirit works through light. The folk spirit with whom we are concerned in these eastern regions works through light's reverberation. As we advance toward the future, from embryonic forms, something will gradually emerge in the East and show a folk spirit active in Eastern Europe that is quite different in quality from the Western folk spirit. I said that this folk spirit works through light. And yet the curious thing is that it does not do so directly, through light's intrinsic vibrations, but through light that first descends to earth and is reflected by it. The folk spirit uses this light, reflected back from the ground, to act upon the Russian people. But this works upon the head rather than the rest of the organism. It works upon modes of thought, on the way in which ideas, feelings, and so on are developed. Here, therefore, the way in which the folk spirit acts is polar opposite to what happens in the West, where it works through the organism and encounters something descending from the head. In the East, the folk spirit works in the medium of light, streaming back from the ground, and this acts primarily upon the head, with a counteraction coming from the rest of the organism, especially from the heart. Coming from the heart organism is a response directed toward the head, altering the effect issuing from there. Today this is still in chaos, enveloped in embryonic sheaths. The respiratory rhythm impacts on the head and neutralizes what comes from the folk spirit, mediated by light. This phenomenon in the Near East exists still more strongly as we move further eastward. It is in general a remarkable and distinctive characteristic of Asia that the folk spirit still acts through the light absorbed and reflected back to work upon the head. Or the folk spirit, who acts through what is no longer light, is no longer even visible. The harmony of the spheres that resonates through everything and which, for the spiritual humanity of the Far East, is much the same as the actions of a folk spirit. The folk spirit here works directly through the harmony of the spheres, this too being reflected back by the earth and acting upon the head. And the rhythm of breathing works against this. And here lies the secret of Oriental spirit seekers, that they have always sought to connect with the spirit by developing their breathing in a special way. If you have studied yoga, you will know about specific breathing requirements. This is due to the fact that the individual, as member of all humanity, does not need to find spirituality individually through the folk spirit. He seeks it, instead, in a way fully founded on his national characteristics. So the further eastward we travel, the more we find this to be so. Refinements of these effects of folk characteristics, or also deviations from them, both more or less common, can show us some of the possible aberrations here. Disharmonies, for instance, arising when the effect coming from the head harmonizes with that from the rest of the organism, and so on. But conditions today mean that it is probably not a good idea to go into detail about possible states of disharmony that arise in different peoples. It might sow dissension instead of love between nations. People might respond emotionally to such ideas instead of reasonably and misunderstand them. At some point in the future, when times change, we may be able to talk about the people of the East and other problems. Now let us return to the people of Central Europe. I am referring to geographical locations rather than to socio-political states. Nor am I speaking in terms of race, but of spiritual geographical conditions. Let us therefore speak of a Central Europe which does not include France and Italy. The distinctive nature of the folk spirit working in Central Europe is that it acts directly through heat or warmth, rather than through air, water, or salt, as in other regions I described. In Central Europe, the folk spirit has chosen this medium of warmth. But this is not fixed or clear-cut. It can be individualized. There are people in Central Europe in whom the folk spirit acts in different ways, sometimes coming from the rest of the organism, sometimes affecting the head. This depends also on whether the external air directly brings warmth, or whether it is conveyed through food or breathing. It is all a medium for the folk spirit. and this action is likewise counteracted by warmth in turn. And so in Central Europe the outer effects of warmth are the medium for the folk spirit, and encounter self-generated warmth or heat working from within the organism. We can therefore say that the warmth working in the organism through the folk spirit encounters the head's self-generated warmth. Where the warmth of the folk spirit works through the head, it meets the warmth of the rest of the organism streaming toward it. Warmth encounters and affects warmth, and specifically is dependent on a greater or lesser vitality of the senses, especially of the capacity of sensory perception. Someone with a lively and attentive mind, who loves to observe everything around him, develops more self-generated warmth. By contrast, someone whose attention is fleeting and superficial, whose gaze merely flits over the surface of things, has much less self-generated warmth. Full engagement with one's surroundings, having an open heart or gaze for one's environment, is what counteracts the warmth working through the folk spirit as warmth meeting warmth. That is the distinctive way in which the folk spirit works in Central Europe, determining much in the quality of national characteristics, because warmth and warmth are so intimately related. The other modes of interaction do not have such mutual affinity. The will is not so closely related to electrical phenomena, nor does the element of salt have such a close affinity with digestive or metabolic processes in the head. The same is true of the other interactions I described, but the Central European character is determined by warmth, and this comes to expression, too, in its capacity to more or less merge with everything. These are not value judgments, but characterizations, and so each person is free to understand them as he likes, whether as a virtue or its opposite. Warmth meeting warmth, this gives a flexible, plastic quality, a capacity to enter into everything, also into the characteristics of other peoples. If we trace the course of history, we can certainly see how the different Teutonic tribes were absorbed by foreign peoples, how they accepted and assumed the foreign element. All this can support what I have been saying. What I have said today also gives a striking sense of the gulf and contrast between the Asian Orient and the American Occident. The folk soul in the East employs light, and even what lies higher than light in the etheric realm, albeit reflected back from the earth, to approach humankind. In the West, it employs the sub-earthly element. This can lead us deep into the organic and soul life of the whole earth organism and its coexistence with humanity. There is absolutely no intention here to affront any part of the earth's population or flatter any other. And yet it is true to say that in the Orient we have a spirit-oriented flowing and streaming, whereas toward the West we meet something weightier below, binding the human being to the earth. I will leave it up to you to decide whether this somehow corresponds to the character of the American people. So, that is how life is. In the East, a rising surge. In the West, an ebbing activity that works more deeply into the earth. Not all at once, but during the course of a lifetime and through successive generations, a person adapts to earthly conditions in each region and develops an affinity with them. If a European moves to the Orient, has children there and grandchildren, the geographical conditions start to act and hold sway. Just as a shoulder can never turn into a nose, but an arm will always emerge from it, so good yogis will never emerge in America. Yoga can be transplanted, but of course you can grow all kinds of plants in a greenhouse. I am not speaking of such things, but of the natural development that arises in different conditions and localities. Mainstream biology does not offer any explanation of different conditions on Earth. And for this, we need to consider the different ways in which the folk souls act, as we discussed today, seeing how what is hidden comes to manifest expression. So the human being is embedded in modes of activity and influence connected with the earth. If you consider this carefully, it will be fully and depressingly apparent to you how greatly people are dependent on powers connected with the portion of earth on which their karma has placed them in a particular incarnation. Naturally, this is part of a person's karma. But there is nevertheless perhaps something oppressive about this fact, and the sense of oppression can become still greater if we do not have insight into all the related circumstances. Looking back to older eras of Earth's evolution, we find an increase in this dependency and ever greater differentiation of humankind across the globe. Yet evolution potentially enables our inner life, albeit not our external configuration, to overcome this dependency. What, let us ask for a moment, could conceivably moderate this dependency on a particular region of the earth, so that people might emancipate themselves from its imperative and develop more freedom? We have considered all the impulses that apparently render humankind dependent on different earthly powers in a particular region. Now, something would have needed to occur to oppose the dependency I spoke of, to counteract and alleviate such conditions. It is clear that something of an entirely different nature from this dependency would, by living upon earth, have a redressing and neutralizing effect on conditions there. What could this be? The mystery of Golgotha occurred at the beginning of our era. We have emphasized many distinctive effects of this in the past. But we need only consider a very apparent, generally acknowledged aspect of this mystery to see that even in terms of something so externally self-evident, it introduced a unique and distinctive quality into earthly life. Christ Jesus lived amongst a people with pronounced cultural characteristics, a people whose actions also arose from a pronounced cultural awareness and character. But everything surrounding Christ Jesus, the mystery of Golgotha, the death at Golgotha, entirely contradicts these cultural forms and assumptions. You see, the people in whose midst this mystery of Golgotha occurred took no cognizance of it. They did not affiliate themselves with it at all, in any individual personal sense, but killed him, cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him." Here occurred something which cannot be for one cultural group or nation alone, which has sense only in terms of contradicting all that follows from limited national characteristics, and which the people in this instance rejected and sought to annihilate. This is the secret of the mystery of Golgotha. It does not have a delimited cultural character, does not emerge from national attributes. Instead, it contradicts everything we described earlier as human dependency on folk characteristics. It is an event occurring upon earth that has nothing to do with such characteristics, a being that contradicts them. Only the annihilating element, death, is connected with such characteristics. The event in question has nothing to do with the nature of the Jewish people, nor of the Roman people, likewise influential in the same region. The Jews cry out, "Crucify him." The Roman figure in these events can, quote, "find no fault in him," close quote, which means he is unable to make anything of what is going on there. The whole event is lifted out of all that can happen by virtue of national characteristics. If you study it carefully, therefore, you will find that the mystery of Golgotha cannot be compared with anything else. There have always been martyrs, of course, in other times and places. But nowhere else have martyrs been killed in this way and for these reasons. The more you study the mystery of Golgotha, the more you will find that it occurred precisely because it has no connection with a specific national or cultural milieu, but because it is connected with all of humanity. Firstly, therefore, we have the principle at work in human evolution that acts in a differentiating way upon humanity. But then, emerging from this differentiation, something that does not belong to it, but is distinctive in its independence from national characteristics. Increasingly, it will become apparent, certainly, that the core of the mystery of Golgotha requires individual understanding. As people increasingly encompass its meaning, they will come to see that whereas earthly conditions, human conditions, are of this or that nature, the mystery of Golgotha stands alone and must be understood as something entirely unique and distinctive, whichever field of inquiry we pursue. Today we traced how folk spirits affect human life. We can explain everything in terms of these folk souls, from the very beginning of humanity's evolution on earth through to today, except the mystery of Golgotha and everything connected with it. In all possible fields of inquiry, we can ascertain every aspect of human evolution on the one hand, and distinct from it, the mystery of Golgotha and its effects. As I have often said in the past, learned theologians today have to admit that no historical evidence exists for the mystery of Golgotha. It cannot be assigned a place in history. Things are not usually assigned a historical significance where no evidence of their occurrence can be found, and this applies in a singular fashion to the mystery of Golgotha and all that is connected with it. Nor ought there to be material historical proofs of this event. The mystery of Golgotha is not meant to be accepted by any person who requires material proofs alone. For it only exerts the right effect on someone who by inner effort summons the will to accept the historical validity of something for which there is no material evidence. External proofs of the event of the mystery of Golgotha will gradually be swept away and vanish as evolution continues. Scholarly critique will sweep them away. But a spiritual grasp of human evolution will regard this mystery of Golgotha, nevertheless, as the nodal point of all earthly occurrences. It has to be grasped spiritually, and accorded its place in the spiritual history of humanity. That is its secret. As time continues, human beings will increasingly seek, not for historical evidence, but for an understanding that this event, occurring as a physical event on the physical earth, must be grasped by supersensible means, and that only then can we come to fully understand its connection with the historical earthly evolution of humanity. Next time, we will speak further of this. The end of Lecture 8, which is the first of these 7 lectures in this second cycle, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy.